This is one of a series of tape slide talks on electroluminescence and semiconductor lasers, recorded May 11, 1966, at the Stevens Institute of Technology, Hoboken, New Jersey. The seminar was organized by Gerald J. Herskowitz, Carl Connerth, and Elliot Schlamm of the Basic Sciences Committee of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, New York Section. A recorded voice interspersed with the speaker will give slide numbers corresponding to the numbered slides accompanying this recording. Begin by projecting slide 0, the title slide, now. The next speaker will present state of the art in gallium phosphide lasers, Dr. Murray Gershenzon, Bell Telephone Laboratories, Murray Hill, New Jersey. Now project slide 0A, a picture of Dr. Gershenzon.
Good. Although the recombination radiation from third bi-bias GAP-PN junctions can be put to the same uses as the spontaneous emission from its lower bandgap cousins, the important new element which is added in gallium phosphide is the fact that most of the emission occurs in the visible region of the spectrum.
Slide 1.
And so let's go back to the beginning, right, and look at the first slide, if I may, where we have plotted the band gaps of a number of semiconductors on a wavelength scale, if you can read this. In order to get light emission in the visible region of the spectrum, the band gap of the semiconductor must fill either in the visible or in the UV. And this means that we could only use the top six or seven materials here. Now, it turns out that of these materials, the two 6 compounds are not at present available as simple PN junctions. Therefore, we are forced to use either the various polytypes of silicon carbide or gallium phosphide or boron phosphide, which is not shown on this table. These three materials are all indirect gap materials, and therefore we do not expect to see stimulated emission. Of the three materials, the one with the simplest materials technology is probably gallium phosphide.
Slide 2.
And so on the next slide, we look at a third biased zinc diffused PN junction in gallium phosphide in action. We're looking at a cleat surface at right angles to our junction plane, which is in there. This point is making contact to an evaporator, an alloy, on the contact to the end layer near the surface. This is the P region. This mesa is about a half a millimeter across. We observe two emission bands, which is separated both spectrally and spatially. There's a yellow-green band, which I hope you can see, which occurs very close to the PN junction itself. Then there's a red emission band, which seems to come from the P side of the junction.
Slide 3.
And on the next slide, we look at the spectra from such a diode. Here is the red emission band, which is the most efficient emission band in such diodes. Here's the green emission. There is also some emission in the infrared. We shall be concerned with the red emission and the green emission. We'll start with the red, and we'll start by showing that this red band is due to donor acceptor pair recombination involving a shallow acceptor of zinc and a deep donor oxygen.
Slide 4.
So, let's go to the next slide then, where we start with P-type material containing zinc. Now, the zinc will essentially be full of holes in thermal equilibrium at all temperatures of interest to us. This sample is now compensated somewhat by a shallow donor, sulfur. We now inject minority carrier electrons. These can be captured efficiently by this ionized sulfur donor. And if our temperature is low enough, such that KT is much less than our donor binding energy, then once the electron gets trapped on here, it can't be thermally ionized back out, and so the minority carrier electron is stuck here. Now, this sample is not in thermal equilibrium. And the only way it can return to thermal equilibrium is for this trapped electron to recombine radiatively with this trapped hole. This is donor-accepted pairing combination, in this case between zinc and sulfur. However, if we take a sample like this and go up in temperature, we begin to get thermal ionization of the electrons trapped on the sulfur back into the conduction band, and these may find another way to recombine. Therefore, the efficiency of the zinc-sulfur pair band will go down as our temperature is increased.
Slide 4A.
Well, the very obvious way around this difficulty is to use a much deeper donor, such as oxygen. Now, if we trap the electron at this deep oxygen donor, we'd have to go to much higher temperatures before we begin to see thermal ionization of the carrier back into the conduction band. So the efficiency of this zinc-oxygen pair band should remain reasonably high to much higher temperatures. The zinc-oxygen band is, of course, the red emission we see in the GAP junctions. Now, let's consider a P-type sample containing zinc as well as both sulfur and oxygen.
Slide 5.
At very low temperatures, we expect the ratio of the zinc-sulfur band to the zinc-oxygen band to depend only on the concentrations and temperature cross-sections of sulfur and oxygen. And so on the next slide, we look at photoluminescence intensities for the zinc-sulfur band, the zinc-oxygen band, first at very low temperatures. Now, as we go up in temperature, we begin to get thermal ionization of the electron off the shallow sulfur donor, and so the zinc-sulfur band goes way down in efficiency. However, the electrons from the sulfur are emitted back into the conduction band, from which they can be recaptured by the oxygen donor, and therefore the intensity of the zinc-oxygen band can come way up. And finally, as we go to high enough temperatures, we get thermal quenching even in the zinc-oxygen band. Now, I mean this scale here to be an external quantum efficiency scale for photoluminescence. Thus, it's apparent that these pair bands are extremely efficient in photoluminescence at low temperatures. And as a matter of fact, even with all of this thermal quenching, there are still reasonable efficiencies for the zinc-oxygen band at room temperature. As a matter of fact, the highest external quantum efficiency we've observed for the zinc-oxygen band at room temperature is 11%. Okay, now, let's take this zinc-oxygen donor-acceptor pair mechanism and put it into a p-n junction, which we do on the next slide.
Slide 6.
Here is a p-n junction, which is in forward bias and contains the deep donor oxygen and the shallow acceptor zinc. Consider the p-side of the junction first. The zinc acceptor levels lie above the Fermi level for holes. Therefore, at thermal equilibrium, these acceptors are essentially full of holes. We now inject minority carrier electrons. These can be captured efficiently by our ionized oxygen donors. And because the oxygen donor is so deep, we expect not too much thermal ionization out of the level. Therefore, we should see the zinc oxygen band rather efficiently on the P side of the junction. This is exactly what we had in photoluminescence. Now let's look at the N side of the junction. Here the oxygen donor lies well below the Fermi level for electrons. Therefore, there will always be electrons on these oxygen donors in thermal equilibrium. We inject minority carrier holes, which can be captured by the empty zinc acceptors. But because the acceptors are so shallow, we expect thermal ionization of the holes out of the acceptors back into the valence band from where they can find another way to recombine. Thus, we would expect that the quantum efficiency of the zinc-oxygen band would not be high on the N side. Now consider the space charge region of the junction. Notice that starting from the N side and extending deep into the junction, the oxygen donor lies below the quasi-Fermi level for electrons. So these oxygen donors should be full of electrons. However, the zinc acceptors lie above the quasi-Fermi level for holes only very, very close to the P side of the junction. Therefore, it is only the acceptors here which should be occupied by holes. Therefore, in the space charge layer, there is no region which contains both electrons on the donor and holes on the acceptor. And therefore, the zinc-oxygen pair band should not be efficient in the space charge region. Well, the emission, the zinc-oxygen emission should be most efficient on the p-side of the junction beyond the space charge layer. Now, we've already seen that the red emission appears to come from the p-side of the junction. So let's look at that a little bit more carefully.
Slide 7.
And in the next slide, we look at the near field spatial pattern on a cleaved surface of such a diode. We have arbitrarily separated the red emission intensities from the green emission intensities, and we're plotting intensities as a function of distance from the trace of the junction plane in the cleavage plane. We can get the position of the junction itself by observation of the junction electro-optic effect. And if we do this, we find that at high bias, the green emission is centered right on the junction itself. However, this is not true for the red zinc-oxygen emission. At low bias, it appears to be coming from the p-side of the junction. Our junction now is just about in here. As we go to higher biases, the emission close to the junction itself saturates, and the emission moves deeper and deeper into the P side. Now, such a result could not be obtained if this red emission were coming either from the N side or from the space charge layer. Thus, the red zinc oxygen band is being generated on the P side beyond the space charge layer. And the actual explanation for this shift is also rather simple. As we go to high biases, we saturate the recombination on the P side of the junction. And then for a minority carrier to recombine, it must move on out past the normal diffusion length into a region where the recombination centers are unsaturated. Therefore, the recombination volume expands as we go to higher biases. Now, in low biases, before we get into the saturation range, we have simple thermal injection onto the p-side and simple recombination on the p-side between donor-acceptor pairs.
Slide 8.
Therefore, the red-white intensity should depend on bias as exponential qv over 1 kt. And so on the next slide, we look at the logarithm of the red-white intensity as a function of bias for a zinc-diffused diode at a number of temperatures. The straight lines have been drawn at each of these temperatures with a slope of Q over 1 kT, and we get reasonable fit the data at low biases as expected.
Slide 9.
Now, in the next slide, we extend such data up to much higher biases. Now we're looking at four zinc-diffused diodes at room temperature. This slope 1 region is the region which we saw in the last slide. And now it turns out that in all of these diodes at high bias, we get into a region where the light depends on bias as exponential QV over 2 KT. This is also the region where we observe this spatial shift. And now it turns out, by simple theory, if we assume that we're in the saturation region on the p-side and the flow of minority carriers is limited only by diffusion, we expect a slope of Q over 2 kT for this region. Then we think we can understand the red emission in GAP, both its mechanism and its kinetics. Let's then turn to the green emission. And again, we start with photoluminescence at low temperatures.
Slide 10.
On the next slide, then, we look at photoluminescence spectra in the green region at 20 degrees K. Notice that our photon energy scale is increasing here to the left. There are many sharp lines and broad bands. I'd like to single out two such transitions. First, the many sharp lines labeled with the numbers here and this broad band are due to donor-acceptor pair recombination involving a shallow donor and a shallow acceptor. And two, the line which is labeled A is due to exciton recombination at a nitrogen atom on a substitutional phosphorus site. Now we can take such a sample and prepare a a diode out of it and look at the electroluminescence also at 20 degrees K, and here is such a spectrum. And by comparing these two spectra, we can identify the same two major transitions in electroluminescence. This is the donor acceptor pair transition. Here is the A line. Now, if we take such a diode up in temperature, the first thing we observe is that the actual intensity of this green pair band begins to come down. The intensity of the A line, as well as its phonon replicas, there's one in here, there's one buried under here. At first, these come up in intensity, they reach a maximum, turn around, and begin coming down, and at the same time, they broaden and finally merge. And finally, at room temperature, all we're left with is a very broad green emission band. Now, the question arises, is this band due to what's left of the A line? Is it due to what's left of the donor-acceptor pair transition? Or is it due to a completely different mechanism? Well, it turns out that we can rule out the possibility of band-to-band recombination because the observed quantum efficiencies in the green band are several orders of magnitude greater than the efficiency one can calculate using the band-to-band radiative rate constant as obtained from a detailed balance analysis of the absorption edge. This holds for N-side injection, P-side injection, and space charge injection. So, in all honesty, then, we really don't know what the mechanism of this green emission band at room temperature really is.
Slide 11.
So let's turn to a topic that we know a little bit more about. And in the next slide, I've summarized the various types of diodes which have been made on gallium phosphide. The structures which I've enclosed in circles are structures which were designed to exhibit the red zinc oxygen band at room temperature. Thus, there are indiffused diodes. For example, you would diffuse zinc into an N-type sample containing tellurium and oxygen. There are out-diffused diodes where one heats a P-type sample containing zinc, tellurium, and oxygen so that some of the zinc diffuses out, leaving an N-type layer near the surface. There are grown junctions which can be made in floating zone by vapor phase epitaxy or by solution epitaxy. For example, one can grow a tellurium doped N-type layer from solution onto a P-type sample containing zinc and oxygen. There are alloy diodes where, for example, one can alloy a tin ball onto a P-type sample containing zinc and oxygen. And finally, there are so-called surface structures where one merely evaporates a metal onto a cold P-type sample containing zinc, tellurium, and oxygen. Now, it turns out that all of the diffused diodes and the grown junctions are simple P-N junctions where the injection is due to thermal activation over a normal P-N junction barrier. However, for the surface structures, injection is due to a tunneling through a thin surface layer. For the alloy diodes, one can have three processes in parallel. If one puts a good N-type regrowth layer onto the P-type seed, one has a simple P-N junction. If, however, one gets no regrowth layer, you have metal in intimate contact with the P-type semiconductor, and all you have is a surface barrier diode, which at forward bias can extract majority head carrier holes, but it cannot inject minority carrier electrons. Therefore, it cannot give rise to radiative recombination. Finally, if you get a little bit of an oxide film between the metal and the substrate, you can see a little bit of tunneling here as well. Let us then concentrate on the simple P-N junctions.
Slide 12.
And on the next slide, we show the current voltage characteristics at room temperature of a typical zinc-diffused diode. We can explain such curves quantitatively if we assume that in different bias ranges, there are different current generating mechanisms which dominate. At the lowest bias, we always find surface leakage currents. Next in the bias range, our current is dominated by recombination in the space charge layer at deep levels. In some diodes at a still higher bias range, the current is dominated by recombination at a shallow level in the space charge layer. And finally, when our bias gets sufficiently high, the dominant current is due to injection beyond the space charge layer. So what we want to do now is put the current voltage and the light voltage data together. And on the next slide,
slide 13,
then, we start by assuming that we could always write this dominant current as exponential QV over NKT, where N may change as we go from one bias range to another. Using this then, in the low bias range where we're dominated by surface leakage, the effective N at room temperature is about 4. In the next range where we're dominated by space charge recombination at deep levels, N starts off being 2. But as we go to higher biases, because of pre-exponential terms out here, N becomes less than 2 and begins approaching 1. If we also get into the region where we have space charge recombination at shallow levels, N will start off as somewhat greater than 1, and as the bias increases, it will approach 1. Thus, in this whole space charge region, we start off with N equal 2, and it slowly turns to N equal 1. And finally, if we go to the highest biases, we have simple injection beyond the space charge layer, the old classical injection where N is equal to 1. Now, let's assume that the red light emission from the P side of the junction, L, can also be expressed in the same form as exponential QV over MKT. Now, we've already seen that below the region of saturation, N is always equal to 1. And when we get into the region of saturation on the P side and minority carrier flow is limited only by diffusion, N becomes equal to 2. So now let's put these two things together for the red light emission from the P side. At the lowest biases where we have surface leakage, the red light will increase as about the fourth power of the current. When we get into the space charge region, we start with the light growing as the square of the current, and this slowly becomes a linear relation. Finally, when we get up to very high biases, we have saturation of the recombination centers on the P side, so M is equal to 2, and at the same time, our dominant current is due to injection beyond the space charge layer, which obviously must be on the N side since the P side is saturated, N equal 1. Therefore, in this range, the light becomes sublinear in current. Thus, our quantum efficiency comes up rapidly and slowly levels off, and finally goes down again. And so we have a maximum in the red quantum efficiency in this range. Now, for the green emission from GAP, N is always equal to 1, which means that the quantum efficiency of the green emission also comes up rapidly and slowly levels off and remains a constant all the way up. Let's look at some of the efficiencies that one can observe from such junctions. And in the next slide,
slide 14,
we show the maximum reported quantum efficiencies for the red zinc oxygen band at room temperature for the various types of diodes, which we've already talked about. Notice that the highest reported quantum efficiency is 1.5%, but that all of these values all lie within a factor of less than 10 of each other. These are average quantum efficiencies, which mean that you can achieve such quantum efficiencies with reasonably high yields.
Slide 14A.
By the way, this value down here of 0.01 to 0.1 is a typical English understatement. What they really mean is 0.1 to 0.3, which essentially brings it into this range. So the red emission from GAP at room temperature is moderately efficient. How about the green emission? The highest reported quantum efficiency for the green emission from GAP is a little bit over 0.01%, or about a factor of 100 less than a number like this. Now, we might note that efficiencies like this are high enough so that they begin comparing quite favorably with the efficiency of spontaneous emission from gallium arsenide diodes at room temperature. So if one can find a use for the spontaneous emission from currently available gallium arsenide diodes, one might use such a diode for the same use. However, the big advantage here is that this emission is in a visible portion of the spectrum. And therefore, in the next slide,
slide 15,
we consider the efficiency of the red emission first, as far as the eye is concerned. The first thing to note is that 1 watt of red light emitted as the zinc-oxygen pair band is equivalent to 20 lumens as far as the eye is concerned. Now, let's take a typical diode operating at 20 milliamps with 2 volts DC followed by bias with an external quantum efficiency of 0.5%. By the way, the power efficiency here is extremely close to the quantum efficiency because the emitted photon has an energy of 1.8 electron volts, very close to the applied bias. Now, with a junction diode area of 10 to the minus 3 square centimeters, we get a current density of about 20 amperes per square centimeter, which places this emission just at the peak of the efficiency of the red band. Here we've indicated the power output in the red band from such a diode in power units and in luminous units. And down here we've indicated the actual brightness that one gets from such a diode.
Assuming all the light exits by the front surface, currently we measure brightness about a factor of 10 lower.
What I'd like to call your attention to is the fact that the normal green emission from copper-activated zinc cell sulfide electroluminescent panels is generally in the range of 1 to 10 foot lamberts. Thus, the actual brightness which one obtains in GAP is much greater than this. And this occurs in the region below where the quantum efficiency begins to drop. So we have ample light here, as far as the eye is concerned, at our highest quantum efficiencies.
Slide 15A.
Now let's look at the green emission from GAP. 1 watt of emission in the green band from GAP has a luminous equivalence of 30 times this. However, the highest quantum efficiencies for the green emission in GAP are a factor of 50 down from this average value. Thus, even with the best green-emitting GAP diodes, as far as the eye is concerned, the red is still somewhat ahead. However, though, the actual brightness observed in these green diodes is only about a factor of 10 less than this, which is still quite ample. Okay, we have some efficient or relatively efficient red and green emitters. Now, what can we do with these? Well, the first obvious thing is to use such diodes in the same applications that we would use the spontaneous emission from gallium arsenide. This can be done because the quantum efficiency of the red is not that much lower than that in gallium arsenide. But the important thing here is that this emission is in the visible portion of the spectrum. So we can think in terms of light-emitting diodes, for example, pilot lights, or traffic lights in the red and green for a model railroad, some light-emitting diodes would have the normal advantages of semiconductor diodes. They operate at low DC biases, they're pretty small things, they should be fairly cheap to manufacture, and they may last a very long time without a significant amount of aging. I say that with my fingers crossed. And in addition, of course, one could use special geometries or use index of refraction matching glasses to squeeze a little bit more light out from these diodes or to actually focus the emitted light so as to increase the apparent brightness. And I can't end without mentioning the possibility of two-dimensional arrays of light-emitting diodes for display purposes. One can make such arrays either out of lots of green and red diodes, which are just glued together, or more elegantly by monolithic techniques, starting with a single large planar p-n junction, which is by epitaxial techniques. Before ending, then, let me just say a word about what sort of material we have to start with.
Slide 16.
A GED can be grown in a number of ways. It can be grown by a horizontal bridgman method in boats. This gives rise to laminates, which are polycrystalline. It can be grown in floating zone, which gives rise to fairly large single crystals. It can be grown from solution at fairly low temperatures, and it can be grown from the vapor phase. The latter two methods obviously can also be used for epitaxial growth. Now, it turns out that for some of these bands, at least the zinc-oxygen red band, we put in a large amount of zinc and presumably a large amount of oxygen. The zinc doping level in these things is about 2 times 10 to the 18 per cc. This means that we can cover up a lot of sins, a lot of miscellaneous impurities which you might have in the starting material. So while most of the work up to now has been done on seeds which have been grown from solution, and this is the easiest way to grow GAP, and they're as efficient so far as any of the other methods, one is not really quite sure what the efficiency will do if one tries to put this zinc-oxygen combination in the right way in these other methods of growth.
Slide 17.
Therefore, in summary, although the light emission from forward bias GAP might be used in things like photon couple circuitry as the spontaneous emission from the other 3-5 compounds, the prime use that GAP will probably find is in applications which involve the human eye as a detector. Thank you.
Dr. Gershenson, are there any questions?
Going to hit him later.
Bob Beard from TI.
Can't you wait until you get on?
I want to ask you a question. You've quoted quantum efficiencies and photoluminescence efficiencies. Did you make any correction for the geometry of the device, or is this from one flat exit surface, all edges in an integrating sphere, or what? How do you really compare all these numbers?
These quantum efficiencies are total external quantum efficiencies, essentially via an integrating sphere.
All sides
that are available that we can measure. It's a little light coming out.
In a continuation of the discussion after Mr. Gershenson's talk, we begin by repeating the beginning of the question by Mr. Weiser.
Weiser, IBM, would you care to speculate whether the low efficiency is due to some kind of recombination killer, radiation, non-radiative recombination killer, or whether a more fundamental reason is involved?
You're effectively asking why the photoluminescence curve comes down. Is that it? At high temperatures? The electroluminescence is much more complicated because as you go up in temperature of electroluminescence, you change the ratio of N-side injection to P-side injection to space charge injection. And the red band can only really come from the P-side. To be really honest with you, I really don't know why it goes down to 11% at room temperature. Now, we would think that in the p-n junctions we make, in the region of maximum efficiency of a half percent or so, the dominant current component is due to space charge layer recombination at deep levels. Thus, if we can get rid of the deep levels in the space charge layer, this might be one way of improving the effective quantum efficiency, that is getting more injection onto the P-side. But how to go above this figure of 11% in photoluminescence, I really don't know whether that's intrinsic or not. The reason for that is that ordinarily I would say that it's not intrinsic, that we're getting thermal ionization of the electron from the deep oxygen level back into the conduction band, and then it finds another kilocenter. this will then say, well, just get rid of kilocenters, but this is nothing new. That's what you do with everything, get rid of the kilocenters and the efficiency goes up. But the thing that I'm not absolutely sure about is that some of this thermal quenching may not be due to the fact that the electron gets all the way up into the conduction band. There may be some something here inherent with the oxygen donor, which is giving us this quenching. I don't know.
Any other questions?
Richard Seed, have you looked at the time resolution that is on the pulsed performance of these units, either with photoluminescence or electroluminescence? Presumably because it's an indirect process, it's fairly slow.
Yes.
And could be resolved, and you might even be able to resolve the time-resolve the expansion into the different regions of the diode.
Yeah, well, the thing which makes this a little bit complicated here is the fact that if one takes photoluminescence, even at very low temperatures, of a donor acceptor pair band, when you're looking at donor acceptor pairs, you have close pairs and far pairs. And if you pulse such a sample, the first pairs which recombine are the pairs which are very close. Because of a coulombic shift, these will have higher energies than the pairs which are far apart. This then means that there's a shift in the spectrum in simple homogeneous material excited in photoluminescence. But now you're saying, can you observe the expansion spatially? No, we have not really looked for that. Well, as a matter of fact, let's put it this way. In order to see these spatial pictures, in order to get enough signal-to-noise ratio, we could not use pulse techniques. We had to use DC techniques, taking a picture of the junction of the plane, of the cleavage plane, with a long exposure time. When we try to do this at high current levels, using pulses, while we just had to spend days to get enough energy through to expose a plate. So while in principle your experiment can be done and might shed light on the actual expansion that way, we have not really done it.
I think there was one more question down.
Redeker, did you say what the maximum efficiency was for the red light at the maximum of the curve with temperature? I don't know, I didn't know as
well. That was on a slide, it was 85% or some such thing. Is that what it was? The first, about 85%, yes.
Now, if you assume you know where your oxygen level is and you assume you have an activation energy, what would that extrapolate to room temperature? In other words, what
the activation.
Yeah.
Well, the trouble with this sort of thing is simply this.
Slide 18.
If you plot the intensity of the emission versus 1 over T, this is what you're trying to get me to plot. The first thing you have to assume is that you have a minority carrier lifetime. Well, only you assume there's a minority carrier lifetime which is independent of temperature, and then just see what this alone does to a single center, or you work up a model where there are two centers. One is the oxygen, the other is another level, and what comes out of one goes into the other. Well, it turns out that on any such model, on a 1 over T plot, you should, once you're at the maximum, do this sort of thing. And now the region you get into a good straight line is above room temperature. And as a matter of fact, the group at IBM has been concerned with the slope of this line above room temperature, where it is a clean line. From the maximum to room temperature, there's no clean line. You're in a transition region. The slope is slowly getting closer and closer to what you might expect, but you haven't reached it.
You have been listening and watching a tape slide talk, State-of-the-Art in Gallium Phosphide Lasers, presented by Dr. Murray Gershenzen of Bell Telephone Laboratories, Murray Hill, New Jersey, at the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers Basic Sciences Committee Seminar, May 11, 1966, Stevens Institute of Technology, Hoboken, New Jersey. Thank you.